This is an ABC podcast.
Is the man behind the election of Donald Trump now trying to oust a pope? Also, who are the so-called quiet Australians lining up behind the ousted footballer Israel Folau with both their words and their money? And young, single and searching for love, is there a man drought in Australia's churches?
I'm not just specifically looking for men in, you know, who are Catholic. Ideally, I would love to marry a Catholic, but I'm really happy to just to marry any man who really, like, I find attractive and who shares my values, but it's amazingly rare to find someone who does that.
Hello there, Andrew West bringing you the Religion and Ethics Report, and that story is coming up. Let's start in Rome, though, where the man who created a president is now taking on a pope.
The pope is the vicar of Christ on earth, full stop. However, when he goes and talks about politics, that doesn't deal with theology or the church or infallibility. And starting with that mass on the Mexican-U.S. border, the Pope has been consistent that all the problems in the world are because of this populist nationalist movement, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Viktor Orban, whether it's Salvini. The Pope should stop focusing on free citizens and populist and nationalist and sovereignty movements that are trying to get their countries back and make their countries stronger. And he should start to focus on the metastasizing cancer in the Catholic Church, or we're not going to have an apparatus of the Catholic Church because it's going to be financially liquidated.
They're the fighting words of Steve Bannon, the millionaire publisher who engineered the victory of Donald Trump in 2016. He was warning towards the end there, especially, about the danger that the church faces from the clerical sexual abuse crisis, a crisis of its own making, and he's right about that. But does Bannon have another agenda? He's been mobilising nationalist parties in Europe, and he had some success in the recent European Union elections. But he's also encountered some formidable resistance to his political agenda from Pope Francis. In a recent exposé, the writer and academic Massimo Fagioli looked at Steve Bannon's plan to politicise Catholics and at the Vatican's efforts to thwart him. So what did he find?
He has been very open and forthcoming about it because in the last year he has created a base near Rome where he attempted to create a training camp or school for young intellectuals who want to disrupt the political order in Europe. And to do this, he tried to create not just a campus in a very large monastic complex a few miles from Rome, but also to enroll some cardinals and bishops that are very openly not happy with Pope Francis. In this, there is the clear attempt of Steve Bannon that was connected to the European elections of the end of May to do for the European Union in the European Parliament something similar to what he did in the United States with the election of Donald Trump. And to do that, he did a smart thing, which was to look at the Vatican first, because every historian knows that the idea of the European Union in the 1940s is a Catholic idea.
But what has Steve Bannon said about Pope Francis?
In a series of interviews in these last couple of years, at least, he said that Pope Francis is the enemy for the social political order that he has in mind, which is founded on a view of Islam, which is all of Islam, essentially incompatible with the Western civilization. He has advocated for a new nationalist party, nationalist policies, anti-globalism. And for this, he's right that Pope Francis is the most visible leader for a reform of globalization that doesn't mean destruction of an international order that is based on international institutions, organizations. So he has been very, very open, saying that Pope Francis is the most important representative of the order that Steve Bannon wants to tear down. There has been no secret about that.
Bannon has tried to craft a very specific type of Catholic ideology in the United States. I think you referred to it as Catholic Americanism. Just explain what that is, what it really means in practice.
Right now, there is a new form of Americanism which is reshaping American conservative Catholic culture in an Americanist way, in the sense that there are Catholics in the United States, like Steve Bannon or like Newt Gingrich, the husband of the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See right now, that see that the purest form of Catholicism, the one that can withstand the test of our time and our future, is Catholicism in the United States in its conservative form. That has endorsed openly, publicly Donald Trump. Steve Bannon, again, Newt Gingrich, and many other Catholic politicians, but also the 60% of white Catholics that in November 2016 voted for Donald Trump and elected him to the presidency.
Now, even though Steve Bannon is a very forceful personality, he knows how to organize. You do say that his campaign in Europe, his campaign to disrupt, if you like, the Vatican agenda, has hit a roadblock. Why is that?
Because I believe that he paid the price of a substantial ignorance of what the Vatican is and what European politics is. In the Vatican, he thought he could find a lot of curial support for his anti-Francis agenda. The fact that is that the Vatican opposition to Pope Francis exists, but is not ideological like Bannon's. It's more institutional, it's more status quo. And second, he misunderstood or ignored some deep rooted skepticism for everything American in Europe, in the European Union, also among right-wingers who haven't forgotten that Americans in World War II defeated fascism. Many right-wingers in Europe right now, the ones that Steve Bannon wanted to befriend, are still nostalgic of fascism, like Italy, for example, my own country. And so they haven't forgotten that Americans and Australians and Canadians, they liberated Europe from fascism, and they don't trust Americans. They don't like Americans. This is something that he didn't know or he underestimated.
But if he's had problems getting some even anti-Pope Francis clergy on side in Europe, it does appear that he's had some success in mobilizing a certain fringe of the European Catholic population, because aren't there Catholics who form the basis of the pro-Orban forces in Hungary and also the conservative forces in Poland?
This is true. There's one difference, is that in the United States, a certain Catholic theological conservatism about doctrine on family, marriage, and so on, it perfectly overlaps with political conservatism. So in the United States, conservative Catholics all vote for the Republican Party. In Europe, it is different, because you may have Italian Catholics, for example, who now vote for the right-wing party of Matteo Salvini, that are not theologically conservative Catholics. So there is a disconnect. And so there are some Catholics in Europe that vote for Orban, for the right-wing party in Poland, Italy, France, but are not particularly interested in the Catholic theological conservatism, which is an integral part of the political conservatism of Catholics in the United States.
I mean, you say that Matteo Salvini in Italy has not really said anything about abortion, which would be a major difference with conservative Catholics in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, not only he hasn't said anything, he said openly that no one in his party has any interest in changing the law that legalized abortion in Italy in the late 1970s. And so here there is a very different way of articulating political conservatism, which is on the rise in Europe in the form of nationalism, anti-immigrant, anti-Islam. That's undoubtedly there. But Italy or Europe at large does not have the movement of a neo-traditionalist conservatism that is typical of the United States.
Given Steve Bannon's very public criticisms of Pope Francis, how has the Vatican responded to Bannon?
They are not elevating Steve Bannon. There's no question that Pope Francis is answering in his own way. So, for example, next week there will be a liturgy in the Vatican to celebrate the anniversary of Pope Francis' visit to Lampedusa 6 years ago, which will be a special liturgy for migrants and for those who help migrants. So this is a very clear signal that the Vatican knows what's at stake, and they are not willing to be silent or to pretend that there's not a big battle for the soul of Europe and what kind of Christianity Europe wants to be part of.
That's writer Massimo Fagioli, who's also a professor at Villanova University in the US. There's a link to Massimo's piece in La Croix and to another revealing article by Robert Mickens, also in La Croix, at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage at the RN website. And you're with Andrew West. Footballer Israel Folau, sacked by Rugby Australia for posting tweets considered homophobic, has raised more than $2 million to fund a legal challenge to his dismissal. More than 20,000 people have donated. But who are they and what are their motivations? Are they only the socially conservative so-called quiet Australians that Prime Minister Scott Morrison talks about? Karen Tong from ABC News Online went looking for some of the donors for a story this week, and she joins us now. Karen, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
Where did you find these people who were very upfront about the reasons for supporting Israel Folau, not just with their words, but with their money?
Basically, I was trawling through the Australian Christian Lobby's Facebook page and another Facebook page, it's Freedom for Faith. So that's a religious think tank. And they were supporting this fund as well by promoting it. And I was going through their Facebook pages, reading all the comments that people were leaving, and I started messaging them and just asking if they would want to tell me why they donated.
And you had a pretty good spread of ages. I mean, I think you had someone who's 72 years old and someone who's in her 20s. What was their general feeling, even grievance, about the Folau case?
Yeah, well, a few things sort of came out that were common among pretty much everyone. And one of the first things which I found was interesting was that they all vented a frustration with being called homophobic or being called bigots. And they really wanted to make it clear. And often it was the first thing they said to me that this is not who they are. They're not homophobic. They're not bigots. But they really, you know, believe in freedom of religion or religious freedom. So I think that was one of the first things that really stood out to me, that pretty much every single response had that.
Mm. Did any of them evince a certain frustration about the way the media had characterised supporters of Folau?
There were definitely a few people that responded to me, and even some chose not to participate in this story or provide any information to me because they were concerned that I was from the ABC and they weren't sure how they would be portrayed, whether it would be fair or not. So they chose not to answer my questions and chose not to participate.
Well, what were some of the flashpoints that caused a spike in donations to Folau?
So actually, I think the GoFundMe fundraising campaign was doing pretty well. I think it had over $600,000 already donated to it before it was shut down. And this was one of the things that actually made people, I noticed, on these Facebook pages, they were commenting and saying, you know, because that fund was shut down, they were going to double their donation when the ACL actually opened up their fund. Another thing that happened was basically when Maria Filao was criticised for supporting her husband on social media, that sort of produced this next spike in donations because people thought that that was really unfair and that was really that tipping point to go, well, now I'm going to support him.
You quote Melissa McClay. She's an aged care worker. She's 30 years old. What was her concern? Because it went beyond the Filao case. She was donating for something, a cause that she thought was bigger than that of Israel Filao.
And it wasn't just Melissa who said this, but I think across the people that I spoke to, there was this idea that they felt bullied for being Christians. And a lot of it was happening on social media. So, for example, if they had expressed a view that was a Christian viewpoint, they felt that people were attacking them. And it could be anything. For example, they could be accused of, you know, not believing in science or believing in fairy tales and things like that. So this was definitely something that was quite personal for a lot of the people I talked to as well.
Did any of them see a threat to their own rights in the case of the Israel Filao story? Did they see the Israel Filao situation being reflected, even if they were not prominent people, in their own lives, in their own workplaces?
Yeah, there was one man, David Stennett. He actually posted some videos on YouTube about his views on this case. And he was really concerned about the fact that Israel Filao was sacked because he had, you know, expressed his belief. And the fact that this is something that Israel Filao had, you know, done his whole life. He had worked his whole life to become a great rugby player. And that was sort of just taken away from him immediately. So he was expressing a lot of concern about that. And then also people like Janelle, who I interviewed, she was saying, you know, it's going to be so hard to even share what the Bible has to say. It's what she believes in. Can she talk about it on social media? There were definitely people that expressed concerns about that.
As well as surveying the views of people who donated to the Filao campaign, you spoke to Michael Callahan. He's the executive director of a Christian legal think tank called Freedom for Faith. What did he say about what he had detected as the reason behind the support for Filao?
Yeah, I think he was definitely of the view that freedom of religion is actually something that, you know, not only affects Christians, and he's the director of a Christian think tank, but he was saying that there was broad support for Israel because freedom of religion cuts across different religions, and even people from who are atheists have a belief that freedom of religion is a good thing in society. And it was just interesting, now we don't have our eyes on like the evidence of this, but he did say that people who were gay, who were Muslim, who were atheists, were approaching him you know, on social media saying that they had donated or did support the fund as well.
Yeah, we did have one piece in the Sydney Morning Herald by an out gay woman who was criticising the critics of Filao, so it's not beyond the realms of possibility to think that might be the case. Where has the Prime Minister now said this case is going?
On 7:30, he was doing an interview and couldn't really talk about the particulars, but he did basically, you know, stress that religious freedom was a core pillar of Australian society and that he thinks there are many millions of Australians who want to see religious freedom protected. So I think as we sort of see the religious freedom bills go through Parliament, we're going to see how much of an impact that this case has made.
Great to talk to you, Karen Tong from the ABC Newsroom, ABC News Online. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Finally today, married at first sight, it certainly is not. That isn't the way the church wants you to meet your spouse. But for some young Christian women who are eager to marry within the faith, is it starting to feel like an episode of The Bachelor? Lots of women competing for a handful of suitable men. Anna Hitchings is a young Catholic writer. She also works for Campion College in Western Sydney. She recently wrote a piece for the Catholic Weekly on the search for a suitable husband. It then appeared in The Australian, and it went viral. RN's Alice Moldovan is speaking here with Anna Hitchings.
It is important to stress that yes, of course there are eligible Christian bachelors around, but there are certainly seem to be less of them now than there used to be. Recently in the National Church Life Survey data, which was I think a couple of years ago in 2017, it found that in Sydney at least, women outnumber men nearly 2-1 in church pews. So this is obviously going to, it just follows with a sort of a logical consistency that this is going to affect marriage options for women like me who are sort of a marriageable age. And I guess what I was trying to identify in the article, well, not even necessarily identify, but what I was trying to state and clarify was the sort of tone of conversation and the general kind of understanding that a lot of women that I speak to who are Catholic, I'm Catholic, or just Christian in general, are feeling. They're just, it is really, really hard to find good Christian men. Like, I mean, not only are there less of them in the churches, but also there just seem to be less men who sort of hold similar values to us in society at large. Like, I'm not just specifically looking for men who are Catholic. Ideally, I would love to marry a Catholic, but I'm really happy to just to marry any man who really, like, I find attractive and who shares my values. But it's amazingly rare to find someone who does that.
Well, you're actually right that where are these men who are church-going, single, and worldly wise? It's only ever two. Is it sort of like having a career that's, you know, skyrocketing, having a social life and having a tidy home? You can only choose two.
I know. And it's funny because that term worldly wise, which admittedly wasn't like an ideal term, has been like pretty wildly misinterpreted by a lot of people who read the article.
What do you mean by it?
Honestly, all I really meant was men who are just sort of socially adjusted, I guess. Like, it's quite amazing how difficult it is for women like me and for a lot of my friends and a lot of other women I speak to, how difficult it is for us to find men who we can just talk to on the same level, like who have the same sort of level of maturity, intelligence, and sort of social adjustment. It's quite surprising how hard it is to actually find men who fulfill all those categories. Generally, people we find that we can talk to, you know, just have a normal conversation with, are men who don't tend to share our faith and values. And the men who share our faith and values tend to be very difficult for us to sort of have any kind of chemistry with or meet on that level, if that makes sense.
Well, this is the interesting thing, because in our post-Me Too world, there is a new dawn in relationships between the genders in terms of interpersonal relationships, but even on international politics on that level with strong men of politics. What makes this a religious issue?
Well, I don't think it is just a religious issue, to be honest. I think that the church is maybe like a small like nexus reflecting what's happening in broader society. I mean, so while I was sort of thinking about this recording, I was thinking about, so what are the reasons that that things have changed so much? I mean, I think back, if you look back in like the 50s and 60s, it was fairly normal in, you know, most people went to church on Sunday. That was like a normal thing. And, you know, it wasn't that hard for men and women to find each other, get married and have kids. And that was kind of the norm. And I think what we're seeing now is that is becoming less and less common, I think, for a lot of reasons. And I also think it's important to point out that I wasn't necessarily trying to identify what the reasons were for the situation that we're in when I wrote the article. I was just kind of saying, this is the situation that we're in and these are the effects that's happening. But I think it is important to look into those reasons as well. So, for example, if you're just looking at the way that sort of social data at the moment anyway, particularly since the 1960s with the sexual revolution, you know, relationships between men and women have changed quite drastically. Men and women are getting married later than ever before. And also women are, you know, generally have more of a focus on career. And so this has actually obviously had an effect on things like marriage. And not just in the church. I think this reflects the broader sort of society. I think there is a bit of a trend of men kind of feeling, I guess, disenfranchised, maybe by the rise of, you know, a more feministic society. And so a lot of men that I see seem to be responding to that in one of two basic ways. Like, I think there is a lot of insecurity. A lot of men just don't really seem to know how to be men anymore. And so there is a tendency either to sort of put on a bit of a macho kind of front to sort of hide that insecurity, or men are just becoming a bit more effeminate. Neither of those are particularly attractive to women, well, not the ones I talk to anyway. But also inside the church, there's sort of also a bit of a reaction against that sort of, against the sort of feminism we're seeing in society. And I think that there's also a trend, I think, in the church of men and women who maybe are a little bit more sheltered from the world by well-meaning parents. And so they tend to be a little bit harder to sort of connect with on a social level. So there's like a whole lot of factors at play.
One thing that you touch on is this idea of men not knowing how to be men anymore. And that's kind of a trope that we do hear about in this, you know, this crisis of masculinity. it seems like a lot of some of these ideas do kind of hark back to more conservative ideas of gender roles. It sort of seems like there's this search for an authority figure, whether that's a new kind of man or an old kind of man, or for someone to take the reins. What would you want this authority figure to look like?
My personal opinion is that women generally are attracted to men who are masculine. You know, I don't think that that's necessarily anything new. But I mean, in terms of the sort of thing that I'm looking for in a man, I think that it's important to find men who do share our values. And so by that, I mean something like, you know, I'm a Catholic and so I believe in living a chaste life. And so it actually can be quite difficult to find men who are sort of willing to sort of be on board with that, particularly if I'm looking outside the church. But in terms of, you know, what's attractive, I mean, I don't really necessarily have a list of qualities that need to be checked off, contrary to some people's opinions. But I think women are attracted to men who are strong, not like overbearing or dominating, but who are strong and who can lead. And that's certainly something that I'm looking for. And I think that that particularly is quite difficult to find. Like men who are kind of well-rounded, who have had maybe a good example of how to be a man by their own fathers. I think, I mean, you touched on the sort of the fatherlessness thing. Well, not necessarily the fatherlessness thing, but I think this does go into that as well. Like I think that nowadays, you know, we're seeing more father absence than we've ever had before. And I think a lot of men are just not actually having the kind of example of how to be a man from their fathers that there used to be traditionally in society.
If there are Christian men listening, if we turn the tables, what would they have to do to become the kind of men that could bag smart, vibrant, young Catholic woman?
That's a good question. I think a lot of men in the church particularly just kind of need to chill out a little bit. Like I find a lot of the men who go to church are kind of intense and they sort of treat asking a girl on a date like it's a proposal of marriage, and it's like that's not appealing and it's a little bit more than is necessary for the situation. So I mean, what I've been saying is that I think more men need to, and I know it's hard putting yourself out there and asking someone out, I appreciate that, but I think that if they really do want to sort of see the results that they're hoping for, I think men do need to sort of be more open to just asking girls out as if it's not a huge deal. And maybe on the flip side of that, maybe women need to be more open to saying yes. I mean, I know there are some men who have asked me out who I just haven't been interested in, or I've gone on a date and it hasn't gone anywhere. But there are girlfriends of mine who would love to date that person, but those guys aren't asking these other girls out. So maybe there needs to be a bit more leniency and openness for both sexes.
To be able to ask each other out.
Well, for men to be able to, for men to be more open to asking more girls out, not just the ones he sees as particularly like top tier, perhaps. And women perhaps need to be more open to saying yes to dates to men they may not necessarily think there's a potential with. And, you know, someone suggested to me that maybe, you know, we should actually be bringing more of our non-Christian friends to church and just to try to sort of introduce them to the sort of circles and societies that we hang out with. And maybe if, you know, if there was a greater pool, the situation might not be as difficult as it is.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming on the program.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Anna Hitching speaking with RN's Alice Moldovan. And that is the show for this week. You can subscribe to the Religion and Ethics Report at the ABC Listen app or at iTunes, where you can give us a rating. Now, this week at the New South Wales Parliament, I'm recording a special edition of the program with the man who's driving the campaign against modern slavery. Kevin Hyland was until recently the UK Commissioner on Human Trafficking, and he's in Australia to meet some leaders. You'll hear that discussion in a couple of weeks. Thanks to Muta Tadias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.